This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the metaversal thought capsule where, in 28 minutes, you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. Post-pandemic, the NHS is in trouble. This week, we're going to look at why and what might most usefully be done. Last year, spending on health and social care in the UK hit nearly £200 billion. That's roughly a fifth of total government spending. Yet the perception has been that things have got worse. Have they? If so, how much worse? How do we compare with other similar countries? And what might we do differently? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what are the main challenges facing the NHS? Siva Anandasiva is chief analyst at the King's Fund, and Professor Carol Proper is a health economist at Imperial College. Carol Proper, even the best funded and run health service would have taken a really big hit from the COVID crisis. What, in your view, are some of the biggest issues that the NHS has been left with as a consequence?
I think the first is that there's been a huge drop in utilisation during the COVID period, and we're only just returning to 2019 levels for both elective and emergency care.
Now, just to be clear, a drop in utilisation, what you mean by that in the NHS is doctors not, or surgeons not being used, operating theatres not being used, and so on.
Well, obviously, during COVID, what I mean is that there were just fewer patients who showed up to the hospital, either because they were worried about getting COVID or because things were cancelled or because they simply didn't show up because perhaps they were ill.
Right. Siva Anandasiva, let's look at waiting times first. And in the first instance for routine surgery, the classic one you always think about is hip replacement operations. Now, how long are people waiting now?
92% of people are meant to be seen within 18 weeks of being referred for something like a knee or hip operation or cataract treatment. And at the moment, performance levels are far below that. 60% of people who have been waiting on the waiting list have been waiting up to 18 weeks. For me, the clearest indication of how long people are waiting are those extremely long waits. People who've been on waiting lists for over a year, and that number has ballooned from about 1,600 people before the pandemic to over 300,000 people now. All the other countries that make up the UK are struggling with waiting lists. I think when you look at routine surgery, though, there are particular pressures in the Northern Ireland system. I think particularly there, nearly half or just over half of the people on waiting lists have been waiting over a year, while in England, the figure's close to 5%. So huge struggles throughout, but particularly in Northern Ireland.
And what about A&E, which is the other one that people most usually experience?
So with A&E, it's a similar story to routine surgery in that performance targets are not being met. So when you go into an A&E department, 95% of people are meant to be seen within 4 hours. If you're only looking at major A&Es, like casualty departments, it drops even further to 59% of people. But again, it's the long waits that really bring it home for me. So if you're on a trolley in A&E and someone's made a decision to admit you to hospital, you can still be waiting over 12 hours before you're actually admitted. And about 400 people were in that group before the pandemic. That's now ballooned to about 20,000 people.
Carol Proper, if we were to try and ascribe major causes to these phenomena, what would we say? Would we say the waiting list is so long because there's no cash or there's not enough staff or not enough capacity?
It's really a combination of factors. And on top of that, COVID essentially has accelerated long-term trends. On the funding side, the growth in funding during the 2010s was about 1.5% per annum, compared to an average of about 3.7 per annum over the entire period since the NHS started, so considerably lower. And in terms of staffing, we've seen a longer term buildup of staff shortages. We entered the pandemic already with around 50,000 too few nurses. Brexit obviously had a little bit of an impact as well. About 5% of the workforce come from EU countries pre-Brexit, and that particularly affected areas like London. Then we see things like the RCN survey last year, the Royal College of Nursing survey last year, reported that one in five nurses were actively planning to leave their job, with a further two seriously considering it. So not only have we got a long-term staff shortage, but it's not going away. We can also see on the pay side that the average nurse pay is down about 7% in real terms, again, over the last decade. And the average consultant pay is down about 14%.
Now, Siva, one of the other things which people notice a lot and which people have talked about a lot recently are ambulance response times. Can you explain firstly how the NHS prioritises ambulance responses?
So ambulance calls to the ambulance service through 999 are triaged into broadly four buckets. And I think the first two buckets are probably the most important for the most serious conditions. So there's one category, category one, which is for immediately life-threatening conditions. So the patient's stopped breathing, the patient's heart stopped, you need to get them resuscitated. And the target is for a response to be there on average within 7 minutes of the call coming in. At the moment, the response times are close to 9 minutes. The second category, which is still serious, people having a heart attack, people having a stroke, the target is to get an ambulance to them or some sort of response on average within 18 minutes. That's where you're seeing particularly long waits, close to 50 minutes at some months, an hour.
Now, what can we ascribe those waiting times for ambulances to?
So I think it's a combination of pressures within the ambulance service itself and all the pressures that are writ large in the NHS, like staffing shortages, rising demand, are absolutely there with the ambulance service. But the second thing is, the ambulance service is one of those services that feels the pressure in other parts of the NHS. So when A&E departments can't admit patients to hospital, that means that they can't take patients who are coming in by ambulance. And that's where you see ambulances queuing outside of A&E departments. And if they're queuing outside of A&E departments, they can't be out there on the road responding to new calls.
And would that extend to, I don't know, things like drugs services and so on, not being able to cope with patients and those patients effectively turning up in ambulances or calling for ambulances?
Absolutely. When you talk to people in the ambulance service, they say you can feel it. You can feel when a fracture clinic has closed or a substance misuse clinic has changed its hours or when a primary care practice isn't open on a particular day. It's that sensitive that they can feel the pressure and see it coming through in the calls they receive.
And I presume that also when they have those patients, then it's not totally clear what they should do with them.
It's becoming clearer. So I think this is one of the positive sides that compared to, you know, if we were talking 20 years ago, the ambulance service was sometimes called a scoop and run service, scoop the patient up and get them to hospital as quickly as possible. Now the NHS is trying to build that panoply of, if that patient needs stroke care, take them to a stroke centre. If they need cardiac care, here's a cardiac centre. If it's fracture, take them to a fracture clinic, not necessarily to the main hospital, but that's still a work in progress.
Okay. Carol Proper, let's look at the other side of the funding question for a moment, which is costs to the NHS. What can we know about how much costs have increased and where the biggest increases in costs are coming from?
I mean, I think obviously staffing is a huge part of costs. And we have seen pay increases for staffing, even though they are below inflation. Obviously, during COVID, we saw huge rises in costs for things associated with the pandemic. In terms of infrastructure, one of the issues is that if we're going to increase capacity in the NHS, we're going to have to invest in infrastructure. And the cost of building that infrastructure in many hospital sites is rising because the cost of land and capital is rising. So I think the NHS faces a range of prices, many of which are rising. And of course, they face inflation in exactly the same way. So in a high inflation era, NHS costs are going to go up a lot.
Siva, what can we say about costs of things like medicines?
So I think if you look at particularly the prices of branded medicines, even though we have government schemes in this country that try and control the price of medicines, as new technologies become available, including genomic treatment, including new technologies, including new pharmaceuticals, and access to those treatments increases, that is going to be one of the biggest drivers of increased spend, not just over the medium term, but over the next 50 years. And actually, when you look at what's driving increasing spending on healthcare in different countries, demography, you know, growing population and aging population is absolutely part of it. But access to new and more costly treatments is also a fundamental part of what's increasing spending.
Let's talk about the pressures of an aging population. It's an easily said thing, but let's try to quantify it a bit. How much is the fact the population is aging a factor in putting pressure on the NHS?
It's a really important factor. We can see it in all developed countries that aging is going on. And a 90-year-old, for example, the estimates ballpark costs the NHS seven times as much as a 30-year-old. And we do have to deal with aging, but there's not just aging. There's the fact that what we're seeing is a real rise in chronic illnesses, illnesses that people live with for a long time, illnesses like diabetes and heart conditions. And they are more costly to treat because they're long-term. Individuals have them over a number of years. So it's a combination of both aging and this issue of multimorbidity, that many individuals who are older have a number of conditions, often where they might interact, making treatment more difficult, making them more frail and more vulnerable to other illnesses. So it's not just people getting older, but it's the nature of how people are getting older, that they get older with multiple diseases and often long-term chronic diseases that are very costly for the NHS.
Carol Proper there with Siva Anandasiva. Too often we discuss these big policy questions as though we were alone on the planet. But out there, other health systems are running and dealing with similar problems. So how do we compare? Mark Pearson is Deputy Director of Employment, Labour and Social Affairs at the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, usually just known as OECD.
Well, before the pandemic, the UK was spending just a little bit above the average, you know, nearly £3,500 per person per year. And to compare that to some other countries, that's about 15% below the French and about 30% below the Germans.
Did you just say 30%?
Yes, that's right. If you wanted to catch up to the German level of spending, you'd probably need to spend today about another £75 billion per year.
And what about other countries?
Well, you know, a lot of the countries are around the level of the UK. That's a fairly typical level. In fact, UK is really quite average in the amount that it spends. As I say, a little bit above the average, but not significantly more. What did happen during the pandemic is the UK spent a lot more on health. So it caught up a fair bit to other countries during the pandemic.
But that was a purely a pandemic blip. So to summarise, we spent a lot less than some of the absolute top spending countries, more than I'd realise. We spend about the average when it comes to the European average. But during the pandemic, that went up because of some of the things that we spent our money on. That's broadly it.
That's it. Yes, exactly right.
Do you think that one of our problems here is that we expect to get France and Germany level healthcare, but only spend at the level of Spain and Portugal?
I think that absolutely is the problem. Yes, the UK spends an average amount of money and it gets average outcomes. It's neither the greatest health system in the world nor the worst. Does some things very well, other things quite badly. It's pretty average.
Okay. Does the extra funding on healthcare in France and Germany mean that, for example, they don't get headlines every winter about a health crisis and that they're not looking at headlines about health spending crisis now?
They're certainly very worried about spending, at least in France, not Germany. I think Germany really does spend so much that that's really not been a problem. So they do worry about the health spending. I don't think it's the same cycle of crisis and political rows about it. They're worried about where their health system is going. They want to improve it. They're worried about the costs, but nowhere near on the level of obsession that we get in the UK.
Let's turn now to the question of GP appointments, because that's been a lot in the news recently, and a lot of people have been talking about the difficulties in getting an appointment to see their GP. How does the system work in France and Germany, and do they have a similar experience?
Well, in France and Germany, it works on a different system. Essentially, you have an insurance, and when you go to the doctor, the assumption is that you pay the doctor. Now, it doesn't quite work like that anymore because they've automated the insurance, and so you can flash a card in both countries, and the payment goes automatically to the doctor. Generally speaking, you can choose which doctor you want to go to. You're not assigned to a particular GP. And so if you can't get an appointment with one, you go and see if you can try and find another one. The countries try and discourage that. They'd like you to go to a particular doctor each time. But there's much more choice in the system.
In those countries in Europe where their spending is actually roughly comparable, is there difficulty in seeing a GP comparable to ours?
Yes, I think that often is the case. I mean, this is a case where more spending, more doctors means more access. I mean, the simple fact is that, you know, UK has 3 doctors per 1,000 people. When you're getting onto some other countries, the average is about 3.5, a bit more than that, 3.5 doctors per 1,000. And that makes a difference.
In other European countries, are they having the same shortages of skilled clinicians and other health personnel that we seem to be experiencing here?
Yes, this is a widespread problem. Indeed, it's a global problem. We are just not training enough healthcare professionals at the moment. Now, other countries are in a better position than the UK because they're starting with more doctors and also with more nurses. The UK is struggling now because it has so many fewer doctors and nurses, and everybody is out there trying to attract doctors to come to their countries. And at the same time, we can't all be stealing the doctors from low-income countries, because the consequences on those countries would be absolutely catastrophic. So it is a case we do need to train a lot more doctors.
But otherwise, what I think I'm hearing is that we are actually in competition with other European countries for skilled clinicians and other personnel.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think also the UK does have a few advantages. The average age of its doctors, in fact, are a lot younger than in other countries. So in some countries, you have over a third, maybe even half of all doctors are aged over 55. And those countries are panicking about what will happen when the doctors reach the age of retirement.
So what would be an example of a country like that?
Well, France. France has an incredibly old stock of doctors. And so it's desperately now trying to find new doctors and train more doctors. But of course, it takes 10 years to get a doctor trained. So this is a long-term problem that we'll be facing.
Is that partly because they pay their doctors more in France, so it's actually more worth their while not retiring?
No, this is an issue that I know the whole narrative in the UK has always been that we don't pay our doctors and nurses enough. And I think there's a good case to say that we don't. But compared to other countries, we do. Doctors are actually fairly well paid in the UK in comparison to other countries. Not to the United States, where we often compare ourselves to, of course. But compared to Europe, generally speaking, the UK is on the higher end of the amount that we pay for our doctors. Now, working conditions are a lot worse, maybe, in the UK, and that maybe explains why there's so much early retirement. But it's not so much a salary issue.
OK. Now, which countries do we have health systems that operate in the same way as ours does in Europe?
Generally, the Nordic countries, Scandinavia, you know, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Denmark, and also some of the southern European countries. So Italy and Portugal are quite similar to the UK system.
They're not insurance-based system. They are centrally funded-based systems where people receive the treatment that they are thought to need for free by simply turning up.
That's right. It's an NHS-type system. They even call themselves NHS-type systems.
Now, how are those countries, the ones with systems that are very similar to ours, how are they performing compared to us?
That's a very important question because, yes, some of them are doing very well. I think the Danish system, for example, is working extremely well at the moment. Some of the other NHS systems, not really so well. I think maybe we should point to Portugal, I think, is struggling at the moment, and some of the other southern European. So my conclusion from that would be it's not the system's fault. It's how we run the system, how we manage the system. We tinker. We tinker all the time. A new way of designing something. And before the results, the assessments are in place that we can learn from them, we have a new health minister, a new government, and we're tinkering again. And we, by the time the results come through, the evidence on what works and what doesn't, we're two or three reforms away from when we did those experiments. So how can we possibly learn and make the system better? Everybody spends all their time looking at the organigram about who they should be talking to, rather than actually improving the quality of care.
Mark Pearson. So, we've heard about what the problems are and how the UK's health service compares internationally, which takes us to an overview of possible solutions. Dr. Jennifer Dixon is Chief Executive at the Health Foundation, an independent charity committed to bringing about better health and healthcare. Jennifer Dixon, we're in the middle of the per capita spending range on health for Europe. Now, if we raised it to, say, the level of France, which we've heard is 15% above ours, how much difference on its own would that make?
Well, it would make quite a lot of difference. I mean, it would ease pressure on budgets. It would allow more spending on training places for staff that we need, because we know the NHS has shortages. It would allow more funds to spend on kits that we need, MRI scans, diagnostic kits and so on, which would definitely help with the elective backlog. I think the NHS's history shows that sudden massive injections of cash of that level actually are difficult, because it's difficult to spend money well quickly. And really what we need is a much more planned increase over time with a strategy behind it to allow the better long-term planning. Because some of the things we're seeing at the moment are simply because we've had a decade of austerity and we haven't been planning ahead in the way we should, particularly for workforce and in particular for capital, meaning kit and all the stuff that we need for early diagnostics and technology.
Now, let's talk about efficiency, because people do at this point. Are there other more efficient ways of working that you can think of that could be practically implemented?
With efficiency, as in any industry, the critical thing here is to have machines and technology do more for us in future to reduce the need for labour costs. That's really the bottom line of what we need to do. For example, in the past, we used to have lots of radiologists reading x-rays and things like that. And now we can have digital technology to read thousands more and be as accurate, if not more accurate, in reading diagnostic tests, for example. Things like that could reduce the need. Telehealth, where people can be treated safely at home through online mechanisms, through video, through virtual means, is also something we've seen through the pandemic. And although we had to do that very quickly, that's another way where we can reduce the need for inefficient travelling, inefficient use of NHS resources. A lot of outpatients can be done at home, could be done through the GP, for example. But I think fundamentally, what we need to be doing is to do two things with efficiency. One is to actually have a much more streamlined throughput through hospitals safely, so that patients aren't hanging around, so that everything works slickly, theatres are used effectively, surgeons aren't hanging around, etc., etc. So that's sort of hospital efficiency. And then the other thing is to try to really do a game-changing piece of work to say what really has to be done in hospital and what can be now done more safely at home. We're drawn into hospital, particularly as older patients, and actually a ton of stuff can be done in the community. For that, you need investment in community services, equipment, skills, facilities closer to home. But that's the game changer, I think.
Right. So, and that's a headline on that, really, which is we don't need to see the people we think we need to see at the places where up until now we've seen them. There are other ways of doing these things which are more efficient.
Which are more efficient, which would then allow us to be far more proactive and reach out to those who aren't coming into the system, who really do need to come in earlier. So, for example, you know, one of the issues why our cancer survival rates are lower than we would like compared to other countries is not because the treatment once you get into the system is no good. It is really good. But it's people who are presenting late because they have symptoms and they've sat on them, and maybe the GP, for example, maybe has not spotted the red flag signals to the extent that they could. So with much more proactive work, and technology can help with this, then the red warning signs will be much louder and we can actually try and improve our rates. That's the biggest way to improve cancer survival, by the way, rather than treatments and new cures, welcome though those are, it's early diagnosis and help. So that's the type of thing which efficiency would make more room for to allow us to do.
Now, those sorts of efficiencies also suggest quite effective use of new technical innovation.
Yes.
Could the NHS innovate better?
That is a really good question, and it's the central one. And yes is the answer, absolutely emphatically yes. We all know that the NHS, as the cliche goes, the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed. Somewhere in the system, there are really advanced technologies, advanced that Germany would think would be advanced, for example, or the US. And the question is how to spread these safely. And there's a complex answer to that. You can't just push it into the system because these technologies can disrupt whole pathways of care. So what you need to do is to work with the staff over time to trial them, to iterate them, to feel comfortable using them, to alter their roles because of the technology and to feel comfortable in that. So this requires patient, good management, a culture of experimentation and a rapid testing and course correction. And that is a cultural change that we need to do, backed up with the mechanisms to test these things more safely. It's entirely possible. And actually, it's a huge benefit of a single payer system that we have, a single system, the NHS. We have fabulous data, we have motivated staff, and we could do this systematically with some big bet technologies. And I think that's the future for changing and sustaining the NHS, rather than the type of retro, top-down, politically driven reforms that we've had in the past, which have a place, but really less of a place in the future.
You don't seem keen on big top-down reforms.
I've just seen so many of them. I mean, I've been looking around the NHS since, dare I say it, 1984, and there've been quite a ton of big ticket. And however they're driven, whether the ideological lodestar is competition and markets, or whether it's a centralised system with targets and performance management, you know, much more of a central run industry, the results are never as good as they're advertised on the tin, you know, and they're costly, they distract. So the real engine of change, if you look at the NHS, is the front line. And we really have to devote time to that technology, data, staff, and focused entirely on that rather than these big ticket sort of levers poking the system to try to do better.
You mentioned staff, so let's talk about that now, because we heard earlier about staff shortages and how one in five nurses are actively planning to leave at the moment. How in broad terms would you address the question of workforce?
Yeah. So there's as everyone knows, there's a workforce shortage, 110,000 in the NHS. That's a 1.2 million staffing quotient total. So that's a lot. And a lot of the shortages are in the nursing profession. So what's happened with nursing is that since 2010, austerity, we haven't invested in nursing, and you can see it in the numbers. And that's a very short-term view, isn't it? You just cut the budget and actually you then have to pay more in the end. So what we have to do is to have a proper long-term plan for nursing and other staff where we calculate how many we need much more carefully than we have. We have a long-term plan for doing it. We cannot grow the domestic nursing contingent very quickly. So what we have to do is get in international nurses where that's ethical, where it makes sense. And actually that is now beginning as a temporary measure until we can homegrown our own nurses. It's perfectly possible. It's not rocket science. We just have to say we'll do it and invest in it and make the right kind of calculations. There are enough people coming forwards to do nurses. There are far more applicants than places. We don't have a problem with that. It's planning and it's getting over this culture of short-termism.
Dr. Jennifer Dixon, my thanks to her, to Siva Anandasiva, Professor Carol Proper and Mark Pearson. And my conclusion is that we need to take a much longer term view of funding, innovation and staffing of health and social care in this country. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Octavia Woodward, Kirstine Knight and Ben Carter. The editor was Richard Varden. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. But if you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds, including What Impact Will the Northern Ireland Election Have?, How has the war in Ukraine changed German politics? And will the Rwanda plan work?
Uncanny is back. The hit paranormal podcast returns with a summer special that will chill you to the bone.
It was a real dream holiday, really.
The family trip of a lifetime becomes the holiday from hell.
Whoever was in that room wanted to do us harm. It wanted to frighten us.
The Uncanny Summer Special. Out now.
What do you think was in that house?
Six very frightened tourists and something else that didn't want us there.
Subscribe to Uncanny on BBC Sounds.